agenda, Secretary's report. So Dr. Bunton, if you could provide your report. I know that this was posted online, as well as the reopening schools update.
My report has been posted online. I opened with giving you a brief update on the reopening of schools. If you'll remember, there was a pause that the governor recommended. Most of the districts participated in most of that pause. We did have a district that came back in on January the 4th, which was a week earlier, but that was Cape Henlopen, and Cape Henlopen has been the forerunner in bringing children in from the beginning of the school year. They're the only district that brings in their elementary students for the entire 5-day week for in-person learning. The others have returned on the 11th. They've come back in different processes based on their hybrid models. For example, one school district started back with its pre-K and kindergarten students. The following week, they rolled in their elementary students, and they will continue to move on up. Others came back with all of their hybrid participants at all grade levels. Remember, in many cases, schools are running an A and BB kind of program, with students coming Monday, Tuesday. Wednesday is usually a cleaning day in schools. Thursday, Friday would be the BB group. So we're operating fully. The two that haven't come back in yet with lots of students are Newcastle County Vo-Tech and Sussex Tech, and they have asked to come in at the end of the semester. It has to do with their CTE pathway course requirements, and they only have high schoolers, so they are carefully watching the grading policies and patterns and the requirements for example, their seniors to finish a lot of their requirements for their fields of study. So we're operating, and things are going well. Remember, a hybrid also includes the option for a parent to choose to have his or her child not come to school at all for in-person instruction, but do everything remotely. The second thing that I really highlighted in the report was the fact that we are working very carefully to develop a vaccination plan. I've given you some literature about what will be happening with educators as we go through this vaccine coordination. And I need to accent that all these plans are very dependent upon the availability of the vaccine. And that is not a plentiful availability at this point. The limitations are going to slow some of the plans down. We're dependent upon what the federal government sends to us. And so we have to adjust weekly depending on how much vaccine is coming into the state. But educators are in that 1B group in the second stage of that, because in the first stage, you're looking at people with complicated medical situations and people over the age of 65. And then we'll come down to the general educator workforce. The third thing that I mentioned very briefly, but again, it's one that when I come back for a meeting next month, we'll have a lot more discussion about the plans, the exacting plans. The state is going to receive with ESSER monies, which is the part of the new, what we used to call the CARES Act. It has a slightly different name now, but part of it is ESSER, which is the part that comes to elementary and secondary schools. The state received $182.9 million, which is about four times what we had originally. The federal law is that all except 10% must go immediately out to districts. And we did send the allocations out to districts yesterday. So $164.6 million was allocated to districts based on their numbers of Title I students. And Title I is related to SNAP and GEAR to, SNAP and TANF as part of the help that we offer to our students and their families who are economically challenged. So we are in the process of finding out the exact parameters for the expenditure of this money. It appears it will be very much like the original funding that came with ESSER I. And the addition that we have found that is going to be enticing to some people is that you can not only update or upgrade your HVAC systems, which was allowed in the old, with the old monies, but you could actually replace your HVAC systems in schools with this new money, which is a change. And so we're waiting to see what the plans are that come from the districts. At the state level, with the 10% that we're holding, we are very interested in making sure that there is going to be money available for helping our students recover from this experience. We, of course, don't know quite where they're operating as far as proficiency goes at this point. We will be holding that money, though, to assure that there is funding for programs that would go through the summer of not only 2021, but 2022 and 2023. The money must be expended by September of 2023. So knowing that sometimes when systems or people get money, they want to spend it very quickly, we want to make sure that we have money to carry our students through the relearning or the additional learning. We've talked about unfinished learning before. And so right now that's the prime way that we're thinking of using our money from the state level. We'll bring you further updates because, as I mentioned, by next month, we will have our plan completely put together. So those are a couple of the highlights. There's a lot of other information in the report. I did want to mention that we've shared with you, you had interest in our conversations with district teachers, union members, administrators, when we met individually with each of the 19 school districts, and we also met with the charter schools to find out how they were reacting to a variety of things and what their concerns were. Basically, of course, there's the uncertainty about vaccinations and schools reopening. Those were always coming up, but it wrapped up into the general topic of communication. And we know that communication is always something that we can improve upon. I've also given you some literature about the COVID vaccine and the plans for that. So I think that will be useful. You have questions usually about attendance. And this is something that at this, the level, the state level, we have to ask each month for the districts. Well, we can pull it, but it takes 3 or 4 hours to pull it because it has to be pulled from individual districts. So I've brought you a recap, and then I have a suggestion. For the month of November, when we talked about this last time, 93.56% of our students were attending on a daily basis. That has changed slightly. In January, 92.86% are attending daily. So it's down about a half a percent. That's a bit typical for this time of the year due to a variety of things, from regular illnesses to just, you know, just life that happens. The winter is a darker period, but 92%, almost 93%, is still a really good track record for our students overall. We will be talking with the superintendents about keeping an eye on their attendance figures, because this is pulled daily and then it can be summarized and pulled weekly and monthly at the local level. We do all have a concern about the students that aren't fully engaged or not attending. So this will be an ongoing project that we will work with the superintendents to make sure these students are getting extra attention. And I think those are the highlights that I wanted to share for my report this month. Is there anything that I can answer for anyone?
Dr. Bunting, I'd just like to say that I'm really pleased, first of all, to look at the vaccination administration plan and how the work that you're doing there. But secondly, and more importantly, I'm very happy that you're thinking long term about the use of this funding, especially focusing on the unfinished learning and, you know, summer instruction. You know, we don't know what we don't know yet. And I agree, I think people tend to think, oh, we need a new air conditioning system. But, you know, we're going to need additional instructional supports for more kids probably than we ever had before. So I was just very pleased to see that, you're holding that money aside. And I'm hoping that some districts are thinking about that similarly, because I think that's going to be a challenge that we're going to be facing for a while. So I just wanted to say good job there. I was glad to see that.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions or comments for Dr. Bunting?
This is Reverend Powell. Thank you so much, Dr. Bunting, for this thorough report. My question is around the second wave of federal funding. And you did address some of the guidelines that have perhaps been more lenient or changed than the first CARES Act allocation. My question is, and this is for my edification, you said this is almost four times as much as it was allocated before. I realize that a lot of opportunity funding is being directed and will be directed based on the settlement. Is there any kind of framework that guides various districts to make sure that they are spending the money equitably with minority and women-owned businesses as they consider contracts and different entities as it relates to spending this money? This is a significant amount of investment into the community, into the various districts. And so are there any frameworks that are established, I don't know, even through the state, or is it even through the districts that adhere to the distribution of this resource?
The distribution as far as the monies going to a district would be done on a per pupil basis based on the Title I count. But what happens once it gets to the district would be under the jurisdiction of the local board. There is a set of guidelines. As I mentioned, they're very much like the ones for the original CARES money, but with the expansion, for example, of the HVAC system purchase, a total replacement. I can get that listing of allowable expenses. You then asked about investment in community businesses. This money would not be able to be used for businesses that are separated out, but of course, some of it might be invested in the repair of an HVAC system or the hiring of some of the services that could add to our considering the SEL needs, for example, if there's a business out there that would be a consulting firm of sorts. But there is a vetting system that would have to go through, and depending on the size of the contract with someone from the community, there is a process that has to be gone through to assure that they're, you know, there's a history of success and all that type of thing. So we can look deeper. I can have further conversation with you about the kinds of community involvement and what might be guiding the selection of various contractors, as we call them generally, if you'd like to have that. And I could also involve our finance person, who actually is the one who is deeply involved in that kind of work, because she's sort of a gatekeeper for the signing off on various purchase suggestions or hiring.
Yeah, thank you so much. Yeah, I would be interested in the procurement process and to make sure that there are guidelines that are in place. All right, thank you.
Dr. Bunting, this is Wally Rushing. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, good evening. And I just want to thank you again for all of your hard work. It amazes me how much you do. I wanted to touch base on one theme that I heard about the expansion relating to the idea of HVAC systems. And it's actually a point of interest of mine with respect to the standards that we have in place that sort of will illustrate for schools if there are air quality issues that they should be getting in front of. And I'm wondering if that clearly that sort of carve out there, or that sort of call out rather, for that permissible use of the funds suggest that there is some additional acknowledgement of that important issue with the outdated systems, but is there some sort of metric that is being used to sort of be a guidepost for the schools to say this is when you need to make that determination?
Part of that's going to be the choice of a district, but we did, before schools began the school year, we went through a process by which we had the air quality checked in our buildings. All of the districts reported out that they had met the metric, and that's a metric that I personally don't have memorized, but you know, our buildings and grounds people are really up on the quality that was predicted, and we checked for that to assure that that was not a reason for delaying the opening of schools this year. There's always that opportunity, though, if you have funding and you are considering a replacement of a system in the near future, that you might go ahead and do it now. But there are metrics, and we have our buildings and grounds people following those metrics and watching those carefully. Again, in some people's minds, this is a possible concern. If you're in an older building, is it safe to go? That's part of the consideration that comes to mind if you're really, really concerned about the spread of the virus and your safe conditions and so forth. So I think some people may take advantage of that because of just the availability of monies and the age of buildings and the effort to take even more stringent measures to assure that a building is very, very safe and healthy. We will soon know.
I'm sorry?
We will soon know what people are going to be investing in. So I think month by month, the report outs from our districts will be very interesting.
Definitely. And that is a point of interest, knowing that there will be some ongoing analysis and attention to that is something that I'm personally interested in. So I'd love to get plugged into that information as it becomes available.
Thank you. We'll keep you updated.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments for Secretary Bunting? Okay. If there are no further comments, thank you very much, Dr. Bunting. You always give such a nice summary beforehand, so it's much appreciated, because you certainly do a lot from month to month, as Mr. Rushton pointed out. Next on the agenda is, and again, I very much wish that we were in person, but we are going to have a discussion with our 2021 Delaware State Teacher of the Year, Kimberly Stocks. So this was awarded earlier in the year virtually. We're going to have a conversation, and we'd like to recognize Ms. Stock for her outstanding contributions for the growth and betterment of the students served throughout Delaware Public Education. Now, as I kind of started with, we would love to be able to doing this in person, but we don't want to miss the opportunity that we can acknowledge your work. So Ms. Stock is a high school teacher at McCain High School in Red Clay School District, and we've asked her to give, we did say we had a long agenda tonight, but about 10 minutes or so of comments, and then we're going to open the floor up to questions, because we know the board member really like to hear from the new Teacher of the Year. So, Ms. Stock, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I just want to verify that you cannot see me. You can just hear me, correct?
Oh, no, that's correct. On our board meetings are just by sound.
Okay, great. But I won't worry about any facial expressions I'm making or anything. So thank you so much for inviting me. I'm absolutely just thrilled to be here. I will speak quickly just because I don't want to speak any longer than the 10 minutes. But I do want to say that, you know, I might be the Teacher of the Year, but truly, honestly, every teacher that I work with, all of my colleagues really do deserve this title. This year, teachers have never worked harder. And we've seen such little results from all of our hard work due to the pandemic and the unique circumstances and everything. I just wanted to start a little bit about, you know, who I am and how that kind of frames what I'm passionate about as an educator. So I am an English learner teacher and English language arts teacher at McCain High School for the Red Clay Consolidated School District. And, but it actually, for me, before I got to Delaware, it actually started for me in Daejeon, South Korea, where I was both abandoned, lived with a foster family, was given a name, a birth date, and then I was adopted by a Caucasian family in Nebraska. And I actually grew up in Lincoln, Nebraska. And here's a picture of us in the 70s. This was a very different family, as you can imagine, especially in Nebraska too. For me though, as a student of color and in school and growing up in Nebraska, I can tell you that racism was a daily occurrence. And I can tell you that the first time that I was called like a chink, which wasn't the first time, but it was the first of many, I didn't even know what that meant. And the irony is that that's even the incorrect racial slur to use for me because I am Korean. I had no idea what that meant. So I experienced both overt racism like this, but I also experienced covert racism too, being told that I should really only date people who were of color like me too as well. So for me and for so many students of color, school was both a source of pain, but it was also really a source of awakening too. And for me, it really all changed for me in my 11th grade year with my 11th grade English teacher. And why? Because she had us read Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And this was the first time that I had read anything from a person of color. And it was something that I could relate to so much. So when my English teacher told me that I should be an English teacher, listen, I never looked back. And I have spent the next several decades really both finding my voice as an Asian woman and also being in different roles, whether in college or in different jobs, as a champion for diversity. But the reality is that what we've been doing the last couple of decades, it hasn't been enough. And case in point, if you just even pay attention to the student Instagram stories from this past summer, every educator and parent should have been reading these and from the views of our students. And just a really quick example, just from the Red Clay Student Voices site, students still are being discriminated against because of their race, as well as being discriminated against because of their LGBT status too as well. And also last year when I surveyed my colleagues about their attitudes about diversity and equity, most of them said they do not see color when they are teaching students. Well, why would that be a problem? Because the reality is that if you do not see my color, then you do not see me. And especially to teach at a school like McCain, where 70% of our students are students of color, we have to see them for who they are. And I think that if you read like Dr. Ibram Kendi's book, How to Be an Anti-Racist, we know that it wasn't enough to just say, we're not gonna be racist. We really have to be anti-racist in both our systems and our policies for education. So there's a couple of things that we can start with. The first thing that we can do is that we can start with our own implicit bias. We all have it, I have it, and we can own it and then learn and do better. We can understand how our implicit bias really affects our relationship with both people that we know very well as people that we just meet on the street for briefly. We can also then have courageous conversations in school and in society. And we have to be willing to say, listen, we're going to be uncomfortable and we might get offended. That's okay, because we're not going to learn if we are not, if we don't experience some discomfort. And then also as educators, we really need to look at the teaching tolerance site, which talks about the social justice standards. And these are four components from K to 12 that encompass identity, diversity, justice, and action. So it's not just saying, hey, it's okay to be different. I'm not racist. No, let's be anti-racist. Let's do something about that. So I'm not going to go over every tenet of my platform, because if you have this, you will actually get my platform in the bullet form. But you can see that part of my platform has to do with equity in education and really being anti-racist, both in what we teach, who we hire, how we are recruiting, how we're retaining, how we are showcasing who our students are. So there's several things that we can do as schools. The second part of my platform has to do with an English learners. And as the Reverend had talked about, there is great inequities when it comes to our English learners. Let's take a look at just my school, McCain. So McCain this year has over 157 English learner students. This represents for us about 17% of our total student population. So 30% of our English learner students and our regular student populations have an IEP. This growth also represents an 80% growth of our English learner population in just 4 years. And these are some of the different languages that our students speak, with the overwhelming majority of our students speaking Spanish. We're also a Title I and Title III school too as well. So not only in McCain have we seen a dramatic growth, but also in the state of Delaware, that we have actually seen over 428% growth when it comes to our English learner population in just the last 20 years. And according to the records for what the state of Delaware looks like, 50%, at least 50% of our English learners are also low income too. And we have to understand really the basic tenets of what federal law mandates, and then really ask ourselves, are we doing this and are we doing it well? First of all, we've got to accept and educate all students regardless of legal status. Also, English learner students must be taught both English as well as grade level content. And if a student is dually identified with a disability, they have to be provided services in both language assistance and for their disability related services too as well. But the reality is that 25% of our English learner students do not have access to an English learner teacher. Why? Why could that possibly be the case if we're trying to follow federal mandate? Well, there's several reasons, but I think simply what it boils down to is that we do not have enough English learner certified teachers. Because first of all, there's just not enough of us. And then also new teachers, there's no requirement for them to take a second language acquisition or English learner methods course. There's not this attitude yet of we're all English learner teachers. And also there's not enough professional development for our veteran teachers and enough incentives for them to also become English learner certified too, or to actually just learn how to teach English learner students effectively too. So the effects of this is disastrous, actually. And when you get this, you can kind of take a look at the different testing scores, and you can see that our English learner students, that the older they get, the farther apart the disparity becomes in their proficiency levels. And by the time they're in high school, it's such a disparity that you can see there. I want to talk a little bit about just a couple of our students at McCain, because I think the best stories are really about real people. Now, of course, I have changed the name, but all of this information is correct. So first of all, there's Christina. She scores a 2.2 on our access test out of a 6.0. You have to score 4.7 in order to graduate out of becoming an English learner. She's in the 11th grade. She is dually identified. She was born in Mexico, but she came to the United States very young because she's been an English learner student ever since kindergarten. Christina recently lost her mother to COVID, but before that, she has been able to get all A's and B's so far in this really challenging situation. Juan has scored a 1.6. He's what we call a slasher because he's supposed to be 11th grade, but really academically, he's a 10th grader. He was born in the DR. He has been in the States for about 2 years, but Juan has missed most of his classes this year because he's the only person working in his family. I saw him very briefly today so he could pick up a book, but other than that, it has been very low attendance. So as a result, Juan has failed most of his classes. Aaron scores a 4.3. He's also in 11th grade. He was born in the DR. He has been in the States for 5.5 years. However, he has been remote since March, and because of that, he's had a lot of difficulty with school. He's depressed, We moved him to what's called accelerated education to try to help him, but he's unable to come to hybrid because he was so afraid of giving his family and his grandmother, who he lives with, COVID, which is what we're seeing a lot with our students. But unfortunately, his entire family, including Aaron, including his two older siblings, who also were English learner students at McCain, and his grandmother now all have COVID, and his grandmother, unfortunately, is in critical care. Carlos, he scores a 1.8. He's 12th grade. He was born in the United States. In fact, 75% of our students were born in the United States. He has been an English learner student since kindergarten, but his parent recently had to go back to Mexico for health procedures. So that was very difficult for the entire family. Because Carlos has had such a difficulty, we moved him to just B-day classes, so he only comes to school every other day. But Carlos suffers from both depression and anxiety, and he has also failed every class for these past couple marking periods. So this is just a quick snapshot of just some of our students, real kids. So again, here is some of my platform, which has to do with how we can provide equitable opportunities for our English learner students. And I've talked about a couple of these things, but one of the things that we can do is that we can use a critical needs scholarship in such a way to help teachers, encourage teachers to, so that the money doesn't have to come from their own pocket to begin with. And not every district does that, but there are a couple of districts that pay for the classes up front, so the teacher doesn't have to front that money. And that's a real discouragement. I've also included this in my references. If we just try to meet the goals set forth by the Delaware English Learner Strategic Plan that the governor has signed off on, we would be able to accomplish this equity and so much more for our English learner students. So I just want to briefly just go back to my Nebraska family. So as I said, I was adopted by a white family. I can tell you right now, my parents are the most conservative Midwesterners you have ever met. But even so, they still taught us that it is okay to be different, and it's okay to love somebody who is different than you. So as a result, my oldest brother has married a Black woman from New York City. And as a result, family today. My parents have both white grandchildren, Black grandchildren, and Asian grandchildren. And we do fight about race. I don't want to minimize that. We do fight about that. But at the end of the day, we still love each other. We listen to each other. And more importantly, we learn from each other. If you would like to follow me on my official accounts, they are here for both Facebook and Twitter. And also on the very last page, if you click on that document, it's going to take you to a two-pager. The first page has both my information, my contact information, my platform information, and on the other side has the information for all of the other 19 District and Charter 2021 Teachers of the Year, because they are also amazing educators too. So thank you. Any questions?
Thank you. I really wish we were seeing you in person, I have to say, because your enthusiasm is, I feel like the energy that you were just putting across just with your voice, and you made the comment at the beginning about facial expression, and I can just imagine that if you were in front of a classroom that all of your students have to get excited because you just, the energy you put off is fantastic. One of my favorite events as being the president of the board is that I get to go to the Teacher of the Year dinner. Then I don't think I ever fully appreciated it until I sat in that room and I got to see the videos and hear from each of you. And we just have fantastic teachers, and it's really exciting to hear what you're doing. So hopefully, we had to do this last year's Teacher of the Year also from a virtual standpoint, but that was really fantastic. And I'm really looking forward to hearing more about what you're doing and your platform as you go forward. So I'm going to open it up to the floor because I know that there may be other questions or comments, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good evening. This is Wally Rushton. I just want to say it's a real pleasure to get a taste of what your students get every day with you. I echo Ms. Sweeney's comments that a virtual format is not denying me the ability to appreciate your enthusiasm. I can, it comes across even in this format. And, you know, I really, you know, the thoughtfulness and intentionality and the rootedness that you have in terms of your own personal experience, is clear that you bring that to your classroom in a way that allows you to connect with your students. And that's a wonderful thing, that they can be seen and heard and educated at a high level. So thank you for all that you do. And I'm looking forward to all the great work you're going to do with the platform over this next year. And just again, thank you for your service.
Thank you. Thank you. Absolutely.
Kim, it's Wendy Turner. I just want to say thank you so much for being here. It's wonderful to hear your voice and your passion. And thank you for sharing all of your truth and your personal story, which is so clearly intertwined in the work that you are so passionate about. So thank you for all of that. I personally took note of the social justice standards, which I think are interesting. And I too will look forward to following you in your journey this year and seeing and understanding your impact. And again, thank you for everything you do for your students.
Thank you. Thank you, Wendy. And thank you for being such a wonderful role model and giving me advice this year as both a colleague and a friend. So I'm very appreciative. I have very big shoes to fill with all of the past Teachers of the Year. Thanks, Wendy.
This is Reverend Powell. I'm sorry.
No, you're fine. Actually, it's always hard to tell if someone's going to talk on these virtual. So please go ahead.
Okay, this is Reverend Powell, and like my colleagues, I am also truly overwhelmed and inspired by your presentation. I just love the great principles that you have there. I'm sure that's engaging with children and young people that you teach. I'd be interested in asking you a question. It might be a little off kilter, but What about your success or your challenges with engaging parents? So we understand that a lot of success, you know, with teachers and children's proficiency and success is around parent engagement. What could you tell me about your advice around parent engagement if someone wanted to kind of lean in that area?
Absolutely. One of the secrets is an app called Talking Points. And what this app does is you set up your classes or you set up your clients. I'm sure you could use it that way too. And you set the language that when you text them, what language it arrives to them. You can text in English or whatever language you choose to. And so when I send out messages, parents can, what will end up happening is, let's say the parent is a Spanish speaking parent. So I will send the message in English. The parent will get the message automatically in Spanish or whatever language that I set for them. So I have my students on here. I have my parents on here as well. And it has really been such a lifesaver as someone who is really trying to really improve my Spanish. And that's okay, because it's actually really good to be a student with my students and allow them to teach me as I'm teaching them. But that's really the number one lifesaver. I also would say that because I am a high school teacher too, I am able to use kind of more teacher social media in a way. I have like a teacher Instagram account and things like that, that parents can follow, that students can follow, past students can follow. And it is a really good way. The name of the game this year is really about being creative. One thing that we have found that I think is actually pretty exciting is that we have always had at McCain a really difficult time getting our parents in for back to school nights or parent teacher conferences. But I can tell you that Zoom has been a game changer. And I think the fact that the parents don't have to put their camera on, that they don't have to say anything if they don't really want to, it's really been a way to bring them to us in a way that we don't have to worry about transportation or about childcare issues. And so really, honestly, we have learned a couple things this year. So, yeah.
Wow, thanks for sharing.
Hi, Ms. Stock. This is Audrey Noble. I'd just like to ask you a question. I was kind of appalled by the fact that you said that only 25% of students, that 25% of our EL students don't have access to EL teachers. Yeah. Every year the board looks at all the data, the achievement data, and we're always concerned about special needs students and EL students, you know, their performance. And you're absolutely right about if they fall behind early on, trying to catch up is almost impossible for them. We have teacher shortages in every area, you know, and we're really trying to address that. But from your perspective, like, what is it that we as a board or the state could do to expand the number of people who are trained in EL? I mean, you spoke about professional development, but are there other barriers as far as how we certify or how they're licensed in our state or anything that you're aware of that the board could really look into?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. And all we have to do is kind of look at some of our neighboring states and what they do and see how we can kind of adopt some of those things. So one of that would be that new teachers, in order to become certified in Delaware, they would need to take some kind of English learner methods class, or it might be called a second language acquisition class. So that they could learn while they're student teaching, while they're doing practicum teaching, and that can be a component of what it is that they do. Because the reality is that we all teach English learner students, but do we do it
right?
The other thing is that, and I don't know how much control the board has over the critical needs scholarship, but you know, when I came to McCain, I was not certified to be an English learner teacher. I was an English teacher, and I had extensive experience teaching adult ESL. So they hired me. I had to, you know, take the classes to become certified. But the reality is that I paid for that up front, and I was able to do that because my husband is the breadwinner. And so I didn't have to worry about how am I going to pay for this. But you're talking about new and hungry teachers. They don't
right.
have a lot of money to
right.
pay for. And I believe that there are other school districts. I don't know if this is correct, but I believe like maybe Caesar Rodney helps their teachers and pays for that up front. Now, of course, the teacher would have to actually complete the certification.
Right.
But the reality is that I learned so much during my classes for certification at UD that I went ahead and just got a second master's because there was so much to learn.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Having been a UD professor, I'm glad to hear that.
it was excellent.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. The other thing I'd like to address, you brought up the issue about examining policies, and I've been involved in some national conversation of how states can examine their policies looking for inequities that, you know, because as you know, Mr. Ebron's perspective is that, you know, policies drive a lot of the inequities that we have in schools. Mm-hmm. And so as a board, if we were more aware of and more use more of a critical lens as we look at policies to see if we're in unintentional ways creating inequities. Is anything, I know they're doing some of this work in the Capital School District for looking at their policies. They have an equity team that's involved in that. Is there anything going on in your school district in that regard that you're aware of?
Well, if you're asking about like from an equity lens, what policies are or are not present, you know, and I am on the district diversity committee, and we are actually working right now as part of that. There's several of us who are working with Dr. Shah, our curriculum instruction person, about how to basically, and this is a huge job, how to infuse those social justice standards that I had talked about, how to infuse those into our normal everyday curriculum. And so, although without meaning to, of course, you know, the fact that we teach the curriculum that we're given without infusing this eye for equity and this eye for learning about us, basically, it is in itself putting students and putting teachers and putting us into a racist situation without meaning to, of course. And so it really is about also another thing that we have looked at as a district is discipline. And of course, discipline this year looks very different. Right. As a high school teacher, I have had, I knock on wood, zero discipline issues. That's not normal. You know, why is it that our male Black students are getting suspended at a higher rate? You know, why is that? And so we have to look at it. And I think that a lot of that does have to go back to kind of, you know, teachers kind of having an attitude, not meaning to be racist, but kind of this idea of, oh, I'm not going to see your color. But again, if you don't see their color, do you really know who they are? Have you tried to take who your students are and made that your curriculum? If you have done that, what are you doing as a teacher, really? You know, I mean, so it's really an important question. And if you don't think that's important, then what is your implicit bias why you don't think that's important? Right. It's such a complex thing. If you're talking about policies for our English learner students, the reality is that we have to hold our districts to a much higher standard. We need to look at those three components that federal law mandates. Because the reality is that how are we meeting that? If we are meeting it, are we doing it in a way that's effective? I think if you look at the failure rates for our English learner students across the state of Delaware, I think you're going to see that we're not doing it. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, and I think there's always been, and finally we're talking about the issues related to having more adequate funding for EL students, just as we do with special education students, instead of just funding them as, you know, as the typical learner. So we're having, you know, we're way behind as a state in that conversation. It's unfortunate, but and I think with our growing population, I mean, it's forcing a lot of these conversations. It's, you know, so I really appreciate the work you're doing. I was able to watch when you received your award and how excited you were in some of the presentations. So that was excellent. So thank you for joining us tonight. And if you don't mind, I might follow up with you on some of these things we've been talking about.
Please do. And absolutely, I invite everybody to follow up with me. If you think that there's somebody that you know, might benefit from just listening to a teacher's perspective. And that's all I am. I'm just a teacher's perspective, a representative this year. I would be more than honored to do that. And in any way that I can help, in any way you wanna, you know, peek a view at what's happening, I can tell you not everything that's happening. It's a difficult year. It's very hard. It's a struggle. It's a struggle for everybody, but, you know, I'm willing to show you something honest.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I know one thing that I would like to follow up on, and I'm going to throw this out there just so you know, this is coming, that language app. I mean, Matt, I've never heard of anything like that. That's pretty cool. I would like to make sure that everybody else knows out about that, because in terms of a way to make sure that you're connecting with people, that's huge. And even if we think back to COVID in the beginning and the fact that there were certain populations that weren't getting, you know, vital information, if it's that easy to do, there's no reason why people can't be crossing that, you know, that boundary or that hurdle. So you have at least one or two follow-ups coming out of it, so I know that. Now, before we move on the Perkins 5, were there any other comments? And we really do appreciate your time here tonight.
Thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, I'm going to take that silence as no further comments or questions. But thank you very much. We appreciate your time. I know everyone on the board would love to be able to have the opportunity to have you in front of us. Maybe we'll be able to do that again. Certainly not right away, but hopefully, we're not doing this for all that much longer. But again, thank you very much. We appreciate your time. Congratulations, and definitely looking forward to seeing what else you do.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you. Goodbye.
Great. Thank you. All right. So next on the agenda is Perkins 5. Since this update and next steps, we'd like to welcome back Mr. Luke Reim, Director of Department of Education, Career and Technical Education Office. We always learn a lot when he's in front of us, and he's going to give us an update on Perkins 5. He's just going to run through the status of Perkins 5 and next steps for us. There's a lot of information, as you know, as I said, we always learn a lot, so he's not going to go into everything in detail, but just there's been information that's been shared, so to the extent that there are any questions based on that, I'm going to open the floor to the board, and I think we probably have Mr. Ryan on right now.
Good evening.
Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to spend some time with you this evening. My name is Luke Ryan. I'm the Director for Career and Technical Education with the Delaware Department of Ed. We're going to run through really four things tonight. So first, I'm going to provide just a little bit of background and review accomplishments around the implementation of our Perkins 5 state plan. We're going to discuss some supports to local education agencies, and then kind of our adaptive model in response to a changing economy and COVID-19. We have a number of other accomplishments that we've been able to put in place since the plan was approved federally in July of 2020. And then we will have a brief discussion on state determined performance levels and kind of a preview of coming discussions in the next several months. So this is just, this slide is a quick recap on where the board sought to establish priority in the Perkins 5 state plan. I would highlight really three things. So the first is, again, Delaware is one of nine states that submitted a combined plan under the Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act, which included Perkins. We continue to be one of only a handful of states that is choosing to align our education and workforce system through these two pieces of federal legislation. Delaware's plan was also, I think, very unique in terms of how it focused on career pathways expansion. So really expanding our work in the secondary space, as well as ensuring that we have kind of institutional alignment across our post-secondary and secondary systems. We shifted considerably around the types of supports that we provide to students with a center on student equity and then integrated services to the young men and women and adult learners that we have the opportunity to serve day in and day out. And then not insubstantially, were a number of fiscal shifts that were made in the Perkins state plan. So two specifically that I would highlight are the allocation of the state reserve fund to increase opportunities for youth and adult learners to focus on student equity and promote a system of innovation. And then the second is Delaware created an alternative post-secondary funding formula that promoted institutional alignment as well as direct service to what is now an expanded definition of low-income adults. So this alternative post-secondary formula, again, was one of only a handful of states that took advantage of this, the ability to do this in the law. Ours, I think, is quite innovative. So jumping down to the next slide. Those kind of three areas of work have since guided the way that we've chose to implement this state plan. So the first is really supporting a change management system and ensuring that our local education agencies and our institutions of higher education are able to connect their programmatic work with student voice and student outcomes. That information, those data sourced in a needs assessment that we were able to stand up for each educational agency, and then a local plan, which both signals these institutions' work over the next 4 years under the Perkins State Plan, as well as how they will apply funding and support students. We've then convened an advisory group around how we think about and focus on middle grades. This, I think, is going to be a very exciting stream of work. The intent of the basic result of the stakeholder group that we convened was that we should focus on the integration of technical, academic, and social and emotional learning for youth. And we should focus on preparing youth to enter high school so that they're day one ready to navigate our high school system, which is, I think, great focus on student transition. We've also convened and are catalyzing post-secondary innovation. So we have formed a working group, which we refer to as the post-secondary CTE cadre. So this is a group of stakeholders in our adult technical centers, as well as our technical and community college system, and their counterparts in adult education, in the Department of Labor, and our Office of Higher Education, to ensure that we are developing an adult career pathway system that accounts for both the work experiences, the knowledge, and the educational credentials that adults enter our systems, our higher education systems with, so that we can accelerate their learning trajectory and increase their opportunity to pursue a good job. And then over the last several months, we have really spent a considerable amount of time providing both targeted fiscal and professional learning support to our educational institutions that are impacted by COVID-19. So we launched a professional learning series for CTE educators. We have a standing problem of practice series where we're showcasing local innovation and to addressing institutional as well as systems problems. We used the reserve fund specifically for secondary education agencies to help offset unanticipated costs as a result of instructional modeling related to COVID-19. So I think we've been as responsive as we've been able to be in terms of how we support educational agencies and educators specifically in delivering CTE instruction in a variety of learning environments. All right, we can jump down to the next slide. So this is just a quick list of things like our top five or six in terms of the last several months. So as Reverend Powell mentioned, he serves on our post-secondary leadership team, which, again, we were one of a handful of states that were invited to participate in a multi-state leadership academy. We received several grants in the last couple months. So the two that I think are really interesting are a youth apprenticeship grant and then our computer science grant. The youth apprenticeship grant will help us to do two things. So the first is we will begin we will enroll students in the registered apprenticeship system while they are still in high school. So we will physically have students who are sponsored by an employer, who are paid as a competitive employee, who are simultaneously earning their high school diploma while working in a good job. And I think that's awesome all by itself. The second component will be to focus on out-of-school youth, so youth who are ages 18 to 24. And creating multiple paths into the registered apprenticeship system through pre-apprenticeship programming and aligned supports with other community-based organizations. What I would highlight in the interdigital grant, this is a really neat private employer in the state of Delaware who has provided some funding through Zip Code Wilmington, where we are marrying industry professionals with classroom educators to kind of co-teach coding. To young men and women up and down the state. Right now, there are six partnering local education agencies and high schools. We're actively seeking ways in which we can scale this type of instructional model where a practitioner and an industry professional are kind of co-teaching on a daily basis. The other two grants listed here are really focused on research and data. So we are, as we expand our post-secondary system to include short-term and long-term credential programs, the registered apprenticeship system, and our two-year system of higher education, we are building a research-based data model around these institutions and around the individuals and programs that we have the opportunity to support. This grant helps us to accomplish that. And then in February, we will formally receive a $1 million research grant that we will run with the University of Delaware. We will run basically three research studies. The first is an exploratory study, or excuse me, the first is a descriptive study around the post-secondary impacts of CTE programming We have then an exploratory study to connect student trajectory across post-secondary education and then labor market participation. And then we will run a causal study focused on the types of experiences that help to maximize student post-secondary outcomes. All right. So the last couple slides are really focused on unanticipated circumstances that have arisen as a result of COVID-19 and how that and then impacts our state accountability model that we established under the Perkins 5 state plan. So there are like three quick disclaimers that I would put out kind of up front. So the first is the relationship, so state determined performance levels are a reflection of the relationship between the Department of Education and the U.S. Department, or excuse me, the Department of Education in Delaware and the U.S. Department of Education. This does not have an impact on our local education agency accountability model or our secondary accountability model, and it does not have an impact on the instructional expectations or what we hope to achieve with students. The second is we are working from the information and guidance that we have today. And I will admit that that guidance is limited. We are also expecting new guidance to be issued almost any day now as a result of the new administration. But as we go through this process, the rules that we use and the process by which we discussed our state determined performance levels may change. And then the third is, last academic year was our what was referred to as a transition year under the Perkins 5 state plan. This academic year, 2021, is considered the first year of implementation in the new federal law. So that is an acknowledgement that we will likely be making recommendations to our state determined performance levels without having actual knowledge of student achievement in the current academic year. That is not by our design. That is as a result of the process that was outlined by the U.S. Department of Education in terms of how we shift or make adjustments to our state determined performance levels. So what our state determined performance levels are is they are both baseline and baseline outcomes and a performance trajectory over the term of the state plan. These are kind of our performance measures for how we evaluate the department's implementation of the Perkins 5 state plan. And the general clause that exists in the law is that the state is able to adjust the state determined performance levels due to what is referred to as unanticipated circumstances in an academic year. And then the process to adjust those performance levels is provided in the slide. The risk then of not making adjustments is that we are will more or less be locked in to the accountability model. And should we not meet a performance target at the state level, we would not be able to adjust or reestablish baseline performance levels in any future year. We can kind of jump to the next slide. So what you have is kind of an outline of the secondary performance metrics, which I'll spend a little bit of time talking through. You have the baseline percentages that were provided in the Perkins state plan. You have a risk level, which is a result of recommendations for calculating federal school accountability. So this was a committee that the Department of Education convened to evaluate the level of risk with specific measures in the state accountability system. Those risk levels are based upon how complete the data will be, how consistent the unit of measurement could be implemented, and how practical the data will be available and reliable. And then the last component is my very rough interpretation of the projection that may occur as we talk through the state determined performance levels. On this slide, then you have the post-secondary performance metrics. On the prior slide, you have the secondary performance metrics. The same outline in terms of slide orientation exists. All right, with that, I will pause, and I am happy to take questions or comments.
Yes, Vince Lofink. Luke, a couple things. Looking at, and I appreciate your presentation. You did a great job, and I saw, you know, impressed by the additional monies you were able to bring in through grants, et cetera, et cetera. When we talked about the Perkins plan that we passed, you said that 2021 would be the first year or implementation year of the new plan. Have we started that grant process? Is that in process for 2021? And are you receiving applications for Perkins grants from the local districts at this point in time, et cetera, et cetera? What's the status of that?
Yep. So we are implementing the Perkins 5 state plan that the board put in motion last calendar year. At this point, we've completed the process of all of our education agencies and post-secondary institutions. They have all submitted their local plan under the new state plan, they have an established performance model as well. So that work, Vince, is complete. Districts are moving forward, local education agencies are moving this work forward.
Okay, and does that incorporate, when you say their plan, that includes like grant requests or applications that they've completed? I just kind of wanted to get a picture. I get the big picture of what was happening on the plan. It was very impressive. It was a lot of work, believe me, but on your part mostly. But the specific grant applications that come in for the Perkins, the 5.5 million that we're getting annually, is that in process?
Yep. The local plan that each LEA and post-secondary institution submits is basically three parts. So the first, there is a narrative component. So this is their plan to implement CTE under the new law. The second component is their locally determined performance levels. So they're establishing their kind of benchmark as well as their trajectory within the metrics that were provided in previous slides. And then that local performance model is specific to each LEA and each post-secondary institution. Okay. And then the third part is the fiscal request. So it is the formal grant request for the amount of money that each LEA receives under the federal distribution.
Right. Okay, thank you very much. I appreciate those answers.
Sure thing.
Hey, Luke, this is Audrey Noble. I'm just wondering, I'm assuming that you're going to propose putting through adjustments for this these determined levels of performance. Is that right?
So that's correct.
Yeah. Okay.
That is correct. So there are a number of things that are kind of moving simultaneously to tonight's presentation. So this afternoon, I sat on a kind of an advocacy group particularly focused on relationship with US Ed and stronger recommendations around how a state would adjust their determined performance levels.
Right.
I have a number of conversations scheduled with our accountability team, with our assessment team, so that we're able to create a rationale for the adjustments to the accountability model.
Right.
That is challenging, I will say that. And we're also trying to coordinate what guidance we are given through the Office of Career and Technical Adult Education through US Ed, as well as what guidance our accountability team is given really under the ESSA state plan, so that we as a department and we as a state are able to respond with kind of one message.
Are you aware of any other states that are doing this adjustment and what they're doing?
Yep. So this afternoon, I sat on a call with 20 states talking through what they intended to do as well. There are two general schools of thought. So the first is take it head on, which is would be my proposal and recommendation. The second school of thought is there are a number of states that are going to wait this out, and they're going to see what happens.
I go with A, too.
It's where I am most comfortable.
I mean, you don't know with the change in the U.S. Department of Education where the reviews are going to be, but
don't know.
It would seem if you're more proactive, you can always adjust back or change. But if you just kind of wait to see what happens to you, So
yeah, the risk for us is if we find ourselves in an issue where the state is in compliance with U.S. Department of Education next year, as an example,
right?
Due to our lack of adjustment, I suppose. At that point, we are locked into that accountability model, and we are not able to make shifts.
Yeah, and that's not good.
And that's I wholeheartedly agree. The one thing that I think particularly that we need to work on is being able to be nimble and making sure that we're able to reflect what our local education agencies and post-secondary institutions truly need. And I don't want our work with US Ed to be at odds with our work with LEAs and institutions of higher ed.
Right, absolutely. Okay, thanks.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, I'm going to take that silence for no. Thank you very much. We appreciate your time and always all the information that you provide.
It is my pleasure.
Thank you. Great, thank you. All right, so as we move through